Hi, I'm Carolyn Beeler. I'm the environment correspondent and editor at The World. For the past several years, I've been covering what I see as the biggest story of our time, climate change. I've traveled to the face of a melting glacier in Antarctica. I've been in the room as world leaders hammer out agreements at UN climate summits. And I've seen cutting-edge carbon capture projects being built under the sea floor. I will never, ever forget sitting with a family in Pakistan who'd lost almost everything, their home and livestock and most of their belongings after catastrophic flooding turned their town into a lake. The story of climate change can feel really big and overwhelming, but being able to sit down and talk with people across the globe about what they're experiencing and how they're trying to help, that makes this story real and immediate. But we cannot do this work without your support. As we close in on the end of the year, we're aiming to raise $67,000, and we are counting on you to help get us there. A generous donor, thank you, has offered to match your gift one-to-one up to that $67,000. That means if you give $50, The World gets $100. If you give $250, The Newsroom receives $500. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation. That is theworld.org/give. I really can't emphasize enough how much your support means to our newsroom. Thank you. And now, on to the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
Supporters of Argentina's new president-elect are cheering today. While skeptics of the political novice say the country is entering uncharted territory.
He's already indicated that he's willing to kind of circumvent legislative processes and govern by executive decrees.
In Gaza, an already dire situation made worse when the means of communications are blacked out.
People can't call each other, you can't call the ambulance, you can't get through to anybody. Never mind that it's dark and there's bombs and there's no electricity and so on.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, a great deal for something you don't really need. Our correspondent joins the garage sale trail in Sydney, Australia, in search of cheap thrills.
Now that's very weird, but somebody might like it.
I love it.
Find out what you got and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for starting this Thanksgiving week with us. The Israeli military said it carried out more airstrikes in Gaza overnight, killing three military commanders from Hamas and destroying a weapons depot. This morning, officials from the Hamas-run health ministry said there was heavy fighting near northern Gaza's Indonesian hospital. Al Jazeera aired footage that appeared to show Israeli tanks operating near the building. Palestinian officials said a shell hit the second floor of the hospital, killing at least 12 people. The World Health Organization yesterday said it evacuated 31 premature babies from Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, and that more than 250 patients remain there. That brings us now to the news from Gaza that has not happened yet, but is eagerly anticipated, a deal to release some of the hostages that Hamas kidnapped in Israel 6 weeks ago. Israeli military forces say two of those hostages were taken to Shifa Hospital early in the ordeal. The World's Matthew Bell has this dispatch from Tel Aviv.
Last night, an IDF spokesperson presented video showing what he described as a tunnel under Shifa Hospital. He said it was about 60 yards long, more than 30 feet underground, and that it had a blast-proof door that had yet to be opened. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari also presented video footage that he said was taken from CCTV cameras inside the hospital. Hagari said that it showed Hamas fighters bringing two hostages inside, one from Nepal, one from Thailand, on the morning of October 7th.
Gunmen are entering another hostage from those countries I mentioned,
into the vicinity. The terrorists are guarding the room. We have not yet located both of these hostages and rescued them. We have not yet located them. We do not know where they are. There are still hostages we need to rescue.
Hagari said that getting those hostages back is a top priority. In recent days, news reports have said that negotiators were getting close to a deal with Hamas to release a large group of hostages. The deal would reportedly mean that around 50 women and children who were kidnapped on October 7th would be set free. In return, the IDF would agree to a temporary ceasefire of several days and possibly the release of Palestinian women and children being held in Israeli jails. In Israel, there has been intense focus on the fate of the 240 people taken hostage in early October. Tens of thousands of Israelis rallied in Jerusalem over the weekend. They demanded that their government do more to win the release of the hostages. Far-right lawmakers have said they want to pass legislation that would allow the death penalty for terrorism. But relatives of some of the hostages held in Gaza have publicly pleaded with Parliament not to pass that legislation. They say it would only put their loved ones in greater danger. Officials from Qatar, which is acting as a go-between for Hamas and Israel in these negotiations, said over the weekend that all sides had agreed on everything except the logistical details. But on Monday afternoon, there was no announcement about a final agreement. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell in Tel Aviv.
In Argentina last night, a far-right economist who got his start as a celebrated TV pundit was elected president with promises to make radical changes to the country, changes that could have a major impact across the region. Javier Milei won by a wide margin over Argentina's current finance minister, Sergio Massa.
Hoy se termina el modelo empobrecedor del Estado omnipresente.
In his victory speech, he said today marks an end to the failed model where the state is omnipresent and embraces the ideas of freedom. His supporters chanted back freedom, but many experts say Milei's election is a leap into the unknown. The world's TB Size Day has been following the vote and joins me. Remind us, TB, who is Javier Milei? Where did he come from?
So Milei is a political outsider. He's a self-described libertarian economist with messy hair and a very abrasive style who likes to criticize socialism. And he ran for president at a moment when people in Argentina are struggling economically after years of state-controlled policies that have cost poverty, few job opportunities, and an inflation rate of 140% this year alone. So Milei was able to capitalize on public discontent, almost anger, by proposing these radical ideas that represent the sharpest turn to the right in 40 years of democracy in Argentina.
So what are some of these radical policies he's proposing?
Well, his main campaign promise was to shut down Argentina's central bank, drop the peso, and adopt the U.S. dollar as the national currency. But he has also said that he supports a free market of guns and human organs. He's also proposing drastic spending cuts. Here is a widely shared video of Milei naming one by one the ministries that he's planning to cut.
Ministerio de Trabajo, Empleo y Seguridad Social, afuera. Ministerio de Educación, afuera.
Ministry of Labor, out. Ministry of Education, out. Ministry of Health, out. The list goes on and on.
Wow, incredible. So basically, Milei wants to shake up the entire system. How's that going to work, though? Because in Argentina, Congress is currently controlled by the left-wing party, right?
That's right, Marco. So the Socialist Party, the Peronist, Los Peronistas, recently won a majority in Congress. So that's going to make it harder for Milei to pass his proposals. And let's remember, a lot of South America is currently governed by left-wing presidents. So he will have to engage in a lot of negotiation. And it doesn't seem like he's the negotiating type. And this is concerning to many people. I talked this morning to Ariana Cohen, a political risk analyst in Argentina.
He's already indicated that he's willing to kind of circumvent legislative processes and govern by executive decrees. And then if he does that, Argentina could end up seeing an authoritarian slide and a backsliding of its democratic institutions.
But to be fair, he has very little political experience, so we'll have to wait and see.
TB, Milei won this election by a landslide, 56-44% for the defeated Sergio Massa. Where did Milei get all this support?
I think his victory shows a resounding rejection of the establishment rather than actual support for the candidate himself. And I say this because Sergio Massa, who he defeated, is Argentina's finance minister, and many people blame him for Argentina's massive economic problems. Here is one voter I spoke with, Nicolas Seliki, a 32-year-old software developer in Buenos Aires. He told me his salary is worth about half of what it was worth a year ago because of inflation.
También considero que es el mejor para la Argentina de hoy porque yo creo que problemas drásticos requieren medidas drásticas.
He says he voted for Milei because drastic problems require drastic solutions.
Milei has said he's an admirer of Donald Trump. Is this admiration mutual? What do we know?
I think so, because Trump actually congratulated Milei yesterday on his social media platform, Truth Social. He said, I'm very proud of you. You will make Argentina great again.
Not to look for other parallels, but picking up on one thing you said earlier, TV, Milei's trademark messy hair. I gather he's actually got a nickname.
Yes. So he's called El Pelucas, which means the wig.
Interesting. So when is Milei supposed to take office?
On December 10th, right around the corner.
That's the world's TV Saizea giving us the latest on the election of far-right candidate Javier Milei as Argentina's new president. TB, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Who doesn't love a garage sale? A piece of art you didn't think you needed? A record album in great condition? An old-fashioned egg beater. So when I heard what the world Sarah Birnbaum got up to over the weekend, I was kind of jealous. Here's Sarah's postcard about an annual Australian tradition.
That tradition is the garage sale trail. Each November, thousands of people hold garage sales across the country on the same day. So you can literally go from garage sale to garage sale to garage sale ad infinitum. You just pull up this interactive map on your phone. Then you enter in your zip code and voila, you can plan your route. Now, there was a total of 5 million items up for sale this year across Australia, which means you can find pretty much anything on the trail.
We have seen an army tank for sale.
Andrew Valder is the mastermind behind this.
The yacht that was used in the film The Great Gatsby was listed for sale on Garisel Trail. There's lots of beautiful antique cars like 1964 Jaguar for sale. But my favourite one is the general manager of Garisel Trail found her partner at a garage sale.
Valder started the garage sale trail 13 years ago in Sydney, and it's taken off since then. All sellers need to do is register, and then they get posters and flyers and all sorts of promotional materials. Valder says it doesn't hurt to have a gimmick to stand out from the competition.
In Tasmania, in a little place called Kingston, people are offering a free pat of a llama with every purchase.
I set out on Saturday, microphone and trail mix in hand, ready to meet some neighbors and look through their stuff. Ooh, clothes. Oh, man, I wish I could fit into this. Those days are long gone, though. No luck in the clothing department. On to the next stop. These look like boxing gloves.
They are.
They are.
Yeah, well, they're the gloves, and these are the mitts that somebody holds.
Hold on one second. That was my neighbor, Maria Foley. Are you a boxer?
Okay. Oh, no, it's just from a boot camp. A friend was running it.
I didn't need 10 pairs of boxing gloves, so I was about to move on when I found it in a box of kitchen gadgets. This is for bananas?
Yeah.
It's a banana slicer cutter in the shape of a banana.
Now that's very weird, but somebody might like it.
I love it. I have little kids. I slice bananas constantly.
Oh, perfect.
This will save me a good 1 second.
Oh,
As I walked around my neighborhood, I kept thinking about something Andrew Balder had said earlier about why he loves garage sales.
Garage sales are a real microcosm of self-expression. It's like a little bit of, this is who I am. These are the books that I used to read or like, clothes that maybe used to fit me that don't anymore. You're kind of putting yourself out there.
And he's right. I sifted through Nirvana and Barry Manilow t-shirts, through manuals like A Practical Guide to Self-Hypnosis, and I even saw a collection of porcelain chopstick holders in the shape of chubby little babies. Suffice it to say, I now know a little bit more about my neighbors. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
You're listening to The World.
Most people think they know all they need to know about Christian rock.
Whether you think it's cheesy propaganda pretending to be cool,
or if you think it's the only pop music unsullied by worldly vices,
you'll find something to love on Rock That Doesn't Roll.
I'm Leah Payne, author of A History of Contemporary Christian Music.
And I'm Andrew Gill, a public radio producer who grew up on Christian rock.
On Rock That Doesn't Roll, we're talking with people who loved Christian rock in its peak era and learning how it affected them as they grew up.
Listen to Rock That Doesn't Roll wherever you get your podcasts.
You ever been there when an uncomfortable question about race comes up, but you don't know how to answer? That's where Code Switch lives. Each week, we're talking about race and how it intersects with every other aspect of your life, from politics and pop culture to history and food. Listen now to the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Haiti, fighting between armed gangs has displaced some 200,000 people across the country. The United Nations Security Council has approved a multinational police force to help bring stability to the Caribbean nation. It's slated to be led by Kenya, but debates and legal challenges there could upend those plans. From Kenya's capital, Nairobi, The World's Halima Gikandi explains.
After the United Nations Security Council approved a Kenyan-led multinational police force to deploy to Haiti, Kenya's president, William Ruto, told his citizens it was the country's honor and duty.
We cannot walk away from the men, the women, and the children in Haiti. It is a call of duty. It is in solidarity with humanity.
Haiti is our business, he said. But not everyone here agrees. There has been a lot of debate about whether this is a good idea for Kenya. Last week, members of Kenya's parliament aired out their concerns.
People want to use our hapless police officers as guinea pigs in their bid to get cheap money.
Madam Speaker, if you cannot contain and protect lives of your people, surely where do you have the guts to take away to protect lives of people in Haiti?
When the debate ended last Thursday, Kenya's parliament did vote in favor of deploying 1,000 police officers to Haiti. That same day, Kenya's high court extended a block on that development over concerns raised over its constitutionality. Civil rights groups are also raising the issue of Kenya's policing history. The police have been accused in the past of violence against unarmed protesters and extrajudicial killings. I asked Kenya Police Service's public information officer, Jared Ojok, about it.
Allegations are there, but we can tell you for sure that our records in all the missions we have been to, we have had a very, very good record.
Indeed, Kenya has a long history of deploying security officers, including police and military, to peacekeeping operations around the world, from Yugoslavia to Somalia. I ask Ojok how Kenyan police would prepare to go to Haiti. He tells me that mission readiness would include mental, cultural, and physical training.
So that as soon as they are on the ground, they have already understanding of cultural issues, they have understanding of the geography of the place, and even the socio-political aspects of the operations.
Joke also emphasized that the police aren't going there to fight gangs, but to help create a safe environment so that the gang issue can be resolved peacefully. Gail Castor is a Haitian political activist and the founder of CEFAM, an NGO that works with women and children in Haiti. She was actually just in Kenya for a friend's birthday. I asked her how she explained the situation in Haiti to the Kenyans she met.
Haiti right now is under a humanitarian crisis. We don't have no food, we don't have no clothes.
clean water. We don't have the hospital. We don't have the infrastructure.
Given all of that, I asked Castor what she thinks about the potential deployment of Kenyan police.
We do not need Kenya to come to Haiti. What we need right now is a transitional government. What we need right now is a Haitian solution.
She and many Haitians do not trust the current prime minister, who came into power after the previous president was assassinated. She also doesn't trust the international peacekeeping missions because they have a bad track record in Haiti.
All this money that they are pouring into those different interventions, why not pouring it into the Haitian communities and Haitian organizations that are credible in Haiti?
On the Kenyan side, the High Court has said they will judge on the legality of the deployment of Kenyan police in January. The government has also said that they will not deploy a single officer until the plan is properly financed and equipped by the international community. For The World, I'm Halima Gakandi in Nairobi.
On Sunday, Yemen's Houthi rebels hijacked a ship in the southern Red Sea. It was just days after the rebel faction that controls northern Yemen declared their waters off limits for Israeli shipping. The ship, the Galaxy Leader, carries cars, but is currently empty. The 25 crew members of this Japanese-managed, British-owned vessel are being held hostage. Brian Carter has been following the story. He joins us from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Start with how this ship was hijacked yesterday, Brian. What do we know?
So the Houthis took a helicopter. They flew this helicopter out to the ship and, in fact, landed on the ship's deck. And we know this because the Houthis actually just released a video of the hijacking this morning where they show the helicopter landing and their fighters coming off the helicopter and fanning out onto the ship. One of the interesting components about this is that though it's British-owned and Japanese-operated, one of the beneficiary owners was actually an Israeli businessman.
Also implied in this incident, as you said, an Israeli billionaire is a beneficiary owner of this vessel. As you look at this incident, how close has it come to being an act of aggression against Israel?
The Houthis have already carried out a number of acts of aggression against Israel. They've launched drones and missiles in one case that a U.S. ship actually shot down on their way to Israel. But I think one of the notable things here is the response from the Israelis, which was highlighting the fact that this is a threat to international shipping and not just Israel. And so Israel pointed out that these hostages are in fact not Israelis. There were no Israelis on the ship.
Brian, what do we know about how the hostages are doing? Are they still on the ship?
We don't know a ton about their condition, but the hostages were taken to Houthi-controlled territory today.
So the Houthis last week declared the Bab al-Mandeb closed to Israeli ships. This is after they joined the war against Israel last month. Describe that stretch of water and why it's important.
At the big picture, the Bab al-Mandeb is similar to the Straits of Hormuz. There is a lot of energy shipping that comes through the straits, so that's gas and oil. In addition, it's also a major thoroughfare for other types of shipping, for other types of goods. So it's a major shipping choke point that the Houthis can pressure. And when they do things like this, when they hijack ships, when they attack ships in these congested, important waterways, it raises insurance premiums and has a bunch of other knock-on effects in economics.
What benefit is this ship and these hostages to the Houthis?
The Houthis, in part, are working alongside the other Iranian proxies and partners in the region. Of course, the Houthis are backed by Iran. Many of their capabilities are provided, in part, by Iran. And so what this is trying to do is, in fact, signal that the Houthis can and will use these capabilities to put pressure on Israel and, by extension, the United States.
I mean, this incident points to kind of overlapping crises. Is this ship seizure about the Yemen war or about the Gaza war?
In fact, I think it's a little bit about both. The Houthis have said it's about Israel's war against Hamas, but it's also about the Yemen war. It shows the threat and the risk that the Houthis pose to international shipping in the Red Sea and the Bab al-Mandeb in a similar vein to the threat that the Iranians pose in the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz.
Brian Carter in Washington covers the Red Sea region for the American Enterprise Institute, updating us today on the capture of a ship in the Red Sea by Yemen's Houthi rebels. Brian, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
The news can be disorienting, and it can be really hard to remember how we got here. That's why we started the Throughline podcast. Every week, we take you on a cinematic trip into the past to better understand the present. Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
I'm Julia Metzger-Traber.
And I'm Tasha Haverty. Join us in the depths of mothers' hearts, minds, and stories.
As we crack open the definitions of motherhood, listen for the unspeakable, and make space for the questions that rise.
What is a mother, we ask?
And everything answers.
Mother is a Question. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter wanted life for people everywhere to be better.
My dream for the future would be peace in the world and freedom from sickness. The best thing we could do is work toward that goal.
From her office in the White House.
She was incredibly instrumental in building those relationships that led to the Camp David Peace Accords.
Rosalynn Carter's global legacy still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Since the war between Israel and Hamas was unleashed, communication blackouts in the Gaza Strip have been frequent. The initial outages were blamed on Israel. It controls the telecommunication networks in the Palestinian territories. It also controls the flow of fuel into Gaza. And these days, it's shortages of fuel that's to blame for the lack of phone service. That's according to the local cellular provider, Paltel. Without phone service, people can't call ambulances or let their families know they're okay. Aid work is harder to do. The despair of those inside Gaza only grows. Dina Temple-Raston, host of the podcast Click Here, reported on all of this and on one way some people have found to stay connected.
When the mobile phone system goes down anywhere there's a war or a natural disaster, it sparks panic. And when it comes to Gaza, a communications blackout has people assuming the worst.
I mean, imagine if you were abroad and you had a family here in Gaza and that internet connection was stable for some point, but then it suddenly blacks out for 24 hours or so.
This is Hamed Abajwa. He's an English teacher in Gaza. And we managed to reach him before the most recent blackout, when no calls were coming in or going out.
The worst case scenario that comes to your mind is that your family and friends were bombed here in Gaza. So my family and friends cried so much and they were so anxious and afraid that we were under the rubble.
When the internet came back on, his friends and family flooded him with calls.
We comforted them. We told them that, hey, everything is fine. We're doing okay. And yeah.
The first time, the internet disappeared for about 36 hours.
The Wi-Fi came back quickly. It feels like someone's pulling the plug and plugging it back in whenever they please.
Even if someone isn't pulling the plug, now Gaza is facing an additional problem: fuel. Its telecoms run on electricity, so without fuel, they're likely to be going down more often and for longer periods of time, like they did over the weekend. Gaza is about twice the size of Washington, D.C., and Paltel started in the 1990s. Its very existence was set out as part of the Oslo and Paris Accords. It was supposed to be part of an effort that would allow Palestinians to manage their own infrastructure, roads, water, telecoms. But Paltel's fiber optic cables, they run through Israel.
So it's easy to be able to kind of shut the internet down.
Helga Tawil-Suri is an associate professor of media, culture, and communications at NYU Steinhardt.
So I generally actually write about media and media infrastructure, mostly in the Palestinian territories, but across kind of Israel-Palestine.
And she says throttling the internet takes more than just bombing cell towers like we've seen in Gaza. She says internet outages could not just be caused by some sort of collateral damage, like getting caught in the war.
There has been bombing of cell towers for sure, but that in and of itself is not enough to just shut down in the way that we saw. That requires the metaphorical flip of a switch. It is a purposeful kind of shutting off.
That said, even when the internet is not being intentionally turned off, even at the best of times, connectivity in Gaza is patchy. And that has more to do with the technology itself.
So Palestinian providers are still functioning on a network that was initially able to sustain about 200, maybe 300,000 cellular users on a 2G network. Today, you have obviously sort of a million more users, but they're still operating on that same kind of infrastructure.
With 3 to 5 times more users on a network that was essentially built for flip phones, it means either you don't get a signal because there are too many people trying to use the network at the same time, or you get dropped calls. Helga says people still have dial-up modems there. But she says those issues don't change the fact that turning off the internet, even when the internet isn't great to begin with, has a huge impact.
Because it's not just simply preventing kind of communication in and out of Gaza, but also within Gaza, right? So people can't call each other. You can't call the ambulance. You can't get through to anybody. Never mind that it's dark and there's bombs and there's no electricity and so on.
Mohammed, the English teacher, said that when the internet disappears, it's not just unnerving. It goes deeper than that.
When we don't know what's going on, it's more scary, basically. This lack of internet connection and so on, it really covers up so much of the atrocities that they're doing to the point where no one knows about it. And that's the issue to begin with. No one knows how bad the situation in Gaza because they can't know when there isn't anyone to report.
That was also a concern for a marketing executive in Saudi Arabia named Bashar Shaheen.
I'm a Jordanian that comes from Palestinian origins.
He was watching events unfold in Gaza, the bombings, the internet blackouts, and he thought there must be something he could do. Bashar already had a bit of a history organizing people.
I had created the translators movement in the Gaza War of 2021, which I collected more than 300 people that speaks all the languages of the world to just translate the news.
As he was trying to think about solutions for the communications issues in Gaza, he saw some people floating one particular idea. People were posting that they should get Starlink into Gaza. That's Elon Musk's satellite network that has been working so well in Ukraine. But Bashar didn't think that would be an option.
And I saw that and I tweeted about it. I said, listen, guys, this is impossible to be happening right now because Gaza is closed. Nobody is allowed to enter. Nobody is allowed to go out of it. So the Starlink thing won't happen.
So he started to look for other things. And he's not a techie guy, but he thought about this one technology you may not even know exists, an eSIM. It's been around since 2016, but it's only become popular in the last couple of years. Like a regular SIM card, it holds your phone number and your account information. But to install it, you don't need to go to a store. You just need to scan a QR code with your smartphone. And what it does is it essentially turns your non-functioning Paltel phone into a phone that can now connect to a different network. It'll roam for one that is online and then use that one instead.
So the people closer to the northern part of Gaza, they connect to the Israeli towers, the cellular towers. And the people closer to Rafah, which is in the south, they connect to the Egyptian towers.
And they're pretty cheap. You can get one that lasts for a week for about $5, or a higher-end one with more connectivity and more time for about $30.
And I'll be completely honest, I didn't know that the eSIMs initiative would work, so I took a leap of faith.
Bashar tweeted out his plan and asked if there was anyone in Gaza who wanted him to email them a QR code that could connect them to a working cell phone network with an eSIM card. The next morning, his social media was filled with barcodes for eSIMs he could send to Gaza.
And when the people knew that that one actually worked, they started sending me tens. Then it turned to hundreds. Then it turned to thousands. So we couldn't keep up with the numbers.
A little more than a week into the project, he has more messages in his inbox than he has time to reply to.
At least 800 messages in it. The people actually found my account on Instagram, so they decided to flood me there. So they're now sending me on Instagram, they're sending me on Twitter.
At first, he was just sending them to journalists and emergency medical personnel. Now he says anyone who asks can get one. He has a couple of friends helping him manage all the requests.
There was a lot of messages of people thanking us.
Thanking him for giving them back their voice and their connection to the rest of the world.
There was a lot of emotional messages telling us that this eSIM might have provided us with one last call to call our loved ones outside of Gaza and just to tell them goodbye.
It's not a perfect solution. We spoke to half a dozen people in central Gaza who said they were too far away from working networks in Egypt or Israel for the eSIMs to work. But in a time of war, when everything seems so unsure, just being able to hear a familiar voice on the other end of the phone can be a welcome lifeline. For the world, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host and executive producer of the podcast Click Here, about the world of cybersecurity and intelligence. The story was produced by Will Jarvis and Sean Powers. It's a holiday in Brazil today, Black Consciousness Day, dedicated to celebrating the contributions of black communities to the country. It falls on the anniversary of the death of Zumbi dos Palmares in 1695. He was the leader of the Palmares Quilombo, a community of runaway slaves and their descendants. Today, there are thousands of these black communities across Brazil, and many are under threat. Michael Fox has a story.
This video went viral last week among housing activists in Porto Alegre, the capital of Brazil's southernmost state.
Bom dia. Então, nós estamos aqui no Quilombo Kedge.
Men in yellow rain jackets and hard hats lift the metal roofing off a row of cinder block homes. Onir Araújo is filming with his cell phone. He speaks from off camera.
Eles estão com a máquina ali para demolir as casas de pessoas que estão.
They have the backhoe ready to demolish people's homes. This community's land right is collective, and this Quilombo community has been here for 100 years. It's recognized by the Brazilian government, he says. The company has no court order for this demolition, and they cannot do this. As part of a movement for black justice in Brazil, Araújo is the top lawyer fighting for Quilombo rights in the state.
Esse momento não cabe qualquer ação.
2.5 homes were torn down before state government officials stopped the demolition. Araújo says the demolition was carried out by a team subcontracted by the Zafari supermarket chain, which hopes to build a new store where the community now stands. This is prime real estate, bordering the city's country club. Most quilombos in Brazil are in the countryside, but Porto Alegre is the city with the highest number of urban quilombos, 11 total. Almost all have been recognized by the Brazilian state, but only one has received the collective title to its land. That means they are all under threat. So is Onir Araújo. He's received death threats for his work defending the city's quilombo communities. It's a very serious situation, he says. The city of Porto Alegre is being redrawn. There is a ton of real estate pressure, all of it impacting our territories, and no one is consulting quilombo communities, he says. Quilombos are protected alongside indigenous territories in Brazil's 1988 constitution. But the process for formal recognition by the state has been glacial. There are thousands of communities that self-identify as quilombos, but they are not all recognized, and only 200 or so have received the titles to their land. When I visited Quilombo dos Alpes last year, they had been waiting for more than 2 decades for their title. They are still waiting. Quilombo dos Alpes overlooks Porto Alegre. Roughly 120 families live here on 140 acres of land. Leader Rosângela da Silva Elias says she was born and raised here. She says her grandmother founded the community after escaping enslavement at the beginning of the 20th century. Brazil was the last country in the Americas to abolish slavery in 1888, but the institution stretched on in some pockets of the country for many more years. Quilombo dos Alpes has faced constant threats. Two of Da Silva's brothers were killed by people trying to steal their land in 2008. At the time, she was also shot and seriously wounded. Drug traffickers tried to force them off their land again last year. We are resisting and existing, says Da Silva. We're not here for the commercial value of the land. This place is in our hearts. It's our history, our roots, she says. But developers and many city planners see the quilombos as obstructing the progress of the city. Sandra Axelrod-Safer is a vice president of the state chapter of the Union of Civil Construction Industries. She sat for many years on the advisory commission to the city's master plan.
Qual é a efetividade de quilombo urbano?
What is the use of an urban quilombo, she asks. A quilombo is essentially a group of people living in shacks wedged into the city. Let's find housing for these people, access to education, access to public services, and these people can integrate as they like, she says. But quilombo residents say their communities and their land, like that of indigenous territories, are interwoven into their culture and history. And quilombos recently received a lift. In July, Brazil's Statistics Institute released the results of its first ever census of quilombo residents. The census revealed that there were more than 1.3 million quilombo members across the country. That data will likely impact public policies for housing, education, health, and infrastructure. Danildo Rodrigues de Moraes is the director of Brazil's National Organization of Rural Black Quilombo Communities. He spoke at the event. We are part of the story of the Brazilian people that the history books don't tell, he said. This census is the beginning, but we need everyone who sympathizes with the quilombo struggle to help us defend the quilombo people's right to our territory. There is still a long way to go. The government bodies tasked with recognizing and titling quilombos were gutted during the previous government of Jair Bolsonaro. They are slowly being reinstated. In the meantime, quilombo communities continue to face threats and also continue to resist. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Porto Alegre, Brazil.
Cocaine trafficking, guns, and extortion all figured into criminal convictions announced in Italy today. A tribunal convicted 207 people in what has been called a maxi trial against the powerful organized crime syndicate known as the 'Ndrangheta. Prosecutors allege the criminal organization's power is so pervasive that it extends across Europe, North and South America, and parts of Africa, and that the syndicate holds almost a monopoly on cocaine deliveries into Europe. In the town where the 'Ndrangheta is based, prosecutors said no aspect of life is untouched by the syndicate. The 207 people found guilty in the case were sentenced to a combined 2,100 years in prison. 131 other defendants were acquitted. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. She was born in small-town Plains, Georgia. Today, the legacy Rosalind Carter leaves behind is global. The former First Lady died yesterday at the age of 96.
My dream for the future would be peace in the world and freedom from sickness. The best thing we could do is work toward that goal.
Rosalind Carter re-envisioned the role of First Lady, acting as a presidential envoy to Latin America, for example, during husband Jimmy Carter's presidency. After the couple left the White House, they traveled the world as election monitors, construction workers with Habitat for Humanity, and global health advocates. Kate Anderson Brower has written extensively about Rosalind Carter. I asked her about the First Lady's role in bringing Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin to Camp David in 1978.
Well, she understood the value of personal relationships. Jimmy Carter is much more reserved than Rosalind, but she grew close to Jehan Sadat, President Sadat's wife, and actually they came to visit Camp David months before the famous summit there. So she understood the value of these personal friendships. And one of the things that, of course, turned Camp David around was when peace talks were breaking down. Carter went to Begin and said, here's a photograph. I was going to sign it for your grandchildren. And Begin broke down in tears. It was a moment where there was going to be reconciliation in this historic accord. And Carter tapped into that personal feeling of hope that there would be peace between Israel and Egypt. And I would suspect that Rosalind Carter had something to do with that autographed photo for the grandchildren. She understood the power of personal connection.
I'm wondering if that initial visit from the Sadats, that kind of pre-visit to Camp David, was that something that Rosalind engineered herself?
She certainly advocated for it. She was very close with Zbigniew Brzezinski.
National Security Advisor at one point, correct?
Yeah. In fact, he was very, very smart in that he kept her abreast of everything that was going on in the White House. So during the Iran hostage crisis, it was known as the Rose Garden campaign, where President Carter would not leave the White House because he was so busy trying to get these hostages out of Iran. And so Rosalind Carter was in constant communication with Brzezinski and the White House. She was out on the road campaigning for her husband. So she really took on that campaign herself. And she was pretty frustrated, actually, with her husband for not going out there more on the campaign trail.
Rosalind did run into trouble, though, when she, along with the support of President Carter, tried to flex her muscle as a kind of co-president, taking the first lady role further than any other first ladies prior to her. Why was there that pushback?
Well, she did attend cabinet meetings, which is something even Eleanor Roosevelt wouldn't have done. And that was quite controversial. And she would sit in the cabinet meeting and take copious notes. But he did not mind it. He would sometimes pass her notes and say, "What do you think of this, Rosie?" which is what he called her. So there were people who she thought were disloyal to her husband, just like Nancy Reagan. And she would tell him they needed to go. And they did. So she was very powerful.
So after President Carter steps down in 1981, he and Rosalind began traveling around the world, monitoring elections in places like Cuba, Sudan, North Korea. There were also, very importantly, global humanitarians. I think about the Global Guinea Worm Eradication Program, a real hallmark of their legacy, Guinea Worm, a disease that can just simply dehumanize people. Tell us about her role in that program and why its success is so important.
When I talked to her for my book about First Ladies, she was really tearing up when she was talking about guinea worm. I mean, just a devastating disease, and how the work that they did was so impactful and important to her. The Carter Center is where they devoted so much of their time. I mean, I believe it was about 52 weeks in the year they would spend devoted to the Carter Center. And what I think is most interesting about them is the way they lived their life. They would sleep on a Murphy bed at the Carter Center. Before they had the Murphy bed installed as sort of a luxury, they slept on a pull-out sofa. So these are people who lived incredibly modestly.
And guinea worm, it's contracted through water that has the larvae of the worm in it. And then the worms basically migrate through the body and come out limbs. And it's pretty horrendous. And the progress against it was not due to a vaccine or some new wonder drug, right? It was through community engagement.
Yeah, awareness about drinking, you know, trying to get fresh water in these countries. And she also did a lot for river blindness as well. So a lot of it was about trying to get clean water to people in Africa. She traveled with President Carter to North Korea, to Sudan, to Cuba, doing election monitoring. I don't think she was fearless. She was very courageous.
One more thing I want to touch on is Rosalind Carter's work on mental health issues, in particular in the West African nation of Liberia. What was her role in helping Liberia build its mental health care system?
In much the same way as what she was doing here in the U.S., she was trying to get rid of this stigma around mental health. And so she was helping to train nurses and midwives to take on mental health and to act as kind of therapists or to be aware of people who were suffering from mental health challenges.
It is such a long list of accomplishments. How would you say Rosalind Carter's impact on the presidency distinguishes her from other first ladies?
I mean, she's a transitional first lady in many ways. She transformed the position. She talked about not wanting to stay in the White House and serve tea. She wanted to be active. When you look years later at Hillary Clinton talking about not being home baking cookies, I mean, there is this sense that what Rosalind Carter wanted, she was a bit before her time, but she made the position of first lady a professional role. So she told me she did whatever she wanted. You know, she would be criticized no matter what she did. In the late 1970s, Jimmy Carter sent her to Central and South America. And there she met presidents of countries, including Ecuador and Costa Rica. And she was talking to them about human rights. So that was really unusual for a first lady, far beyond photos at hospitals and schools. She was talking to global leaders about their need to treat their citizens more humanely.
Right. And took a crash course in Spanish and, from what I understand, did pretty well.
Yeah, she did. And she was obsessive about it. Her press secretary told me that everyone else would be asleep on the plane and he would see her up, you know, 1-2 in the morning learning her Spanish. So she was dedicated.
Kate Anderson Brower is the author of First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. She's been telling us about the global legacy of Rosalynn Carter, who died yesterday at the age of 96. Kate, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. A quick note before we go. We are in the middle of our fall fundraising drive and need your help. A generous donor has set a challenge match for us. If we are able to raise $67,000 by December 31st, each donation will be matched one for one. Every gift counts towards our goal. I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. From PRX.